Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Journal Republican, reading stories dated September 17th through 23rd, 2020. We'll start with the article headlined Members Sought for School Equity and Diversity Group by Steve Hoffman, September 23rd. The Monticello School District is looking for residents to serve on an Equity and Diversity Issues Study Group. The group will be made up of students, teachers, parents, and community members, and will focus specifically on the school district, said School Superintendent Vic Zimmerman. Meetings will be held on Tuesday evenings in October and November. A report will be made to the school board in December. Those interested in being considered for the committee can email Zimmerman at zimvi@sages.us. Students lead Global Climate Action Day effort, September 23rd. Monticello youth are calling on community members of all ages to join in a demonstration in honor of the Global Day of Climate Action on Friday, September 25th. This Day of Action is a worldwide initiative, and Monticello will be among hundreds of cities and towns around the world taking part. There is no better time to call on the community for support than now. Monticello can truly be a powerful voice for the climate movement and inspire other small towns to do the same, said Monticello High School student Claire Keating. The form of many events will be adjusted due to COVID-19, and accordingly, Monticello's organizers are calling on people to take action at home and share their messages and actions digitally. They are encouraging everyone to create posters and art around their home to amplify the community's climate concerns. Some examples include sidewalk chalk drawings, colorful images on a window or yard sign. In addition, they're asking community members to wear green in support of this important day. Organizers say this initiative will raise awareness and inspire towns to fight for our children's futures. Organizers are calling on other community groups and businesses to get involved. Use the hashtag MonticelloGoesGreen to share your creative messages on social media. I think it is vital that the young people in our community can be a voice for change. I believe that working together to aid the environment is an important issue to tackle, especially during these times, said Sophie Rund, another MHS student. I'd say it's a great opportunity to show that rural areas like Piatt County are not unaware of or disconnected from the mounting climate issues impacting our planet. Raising awareness with this event demonstrates that citizens really care about protecting our local environment and are working to help make our area and the world around us a better place for us all, added MHS student Riley Combs. For more information or to get involved in the planning, visit the Facebook event, https://fb.me/e/4MJC SXRX or email cekeating03@gmail.com. School Superintendent, don't forget about remote learners, September 22nd. The first 5 weeks of in-person instruction at Bement Schools has gone well, according to School Superintendent Sheila Greenwood. She told the school board September 16th that students are masking and staff are doing a good job of giving kids breaks outside. Teachers are also being reminded not to forget about the families that chose online learning only, which include 63 students who make up about 20% of the student population this fall. We worked last week to make connections with our remote-only learners, just to let them know that we appreciate them, miss them, and that they are still very much a part of our school, Greenwood said. We have heard mostly great things from our students and parents regarding the remote learning. She added that one complaint has been that online learning is more difficult than it was in the spring. Last year, we were not allowed to do very much in the way of teaching new concepts and assessing students. Everyone is getting used to it, and have found the resources useful when needed. It is challenging, and that is what we wanted for our students, both at home and at school, said the superintendent. The district has spent COVID-19-related CARES dollars on cleaning supplies, materials, teacher training, and technology needs, and has about $10,000 remaining. Three transitional planning days are planned for staff in the next month, which will be used to prepare teachers to shift to an all-online platform if needed. Greenwood also complimented district nurse Michelle Soise and administrative assistants Kathy Morell and Carla Bradley for their extra work in this unique school year. They have really added a lot to their plates as they manage student attendance, student absences, and lengths of stay for isolation and quarantining, she said. The superintendent said she also hopes more people will begin taking advantage of the district's free breakfast and lunch offerings for remote students, pointing out that just 6 remote students requested meals last week. Budget. The school board approved the district budget for 2020-21. Overall, it is a balanced document. The education fund is estimated to break even. The operations and maintenance fund has a $90,000 budget surplus. And the transportation line item is estimated to spend about $34,000 more than it takes in for the budget year. In other action, the board approved the hire of B.J. Schaefer as the yearbook sponsor. Was told a virtual open house is being planned. Similarly, a Parkland financial aid presentation on September 30th will be done via Zoom. Parent-teacher conferences October 6th through 7th will be done by video and phone conference. And a FAFSA meeting on October 7th will be done in a virtual format to be determined. Heard that Haley Gadbury is the BHS correspondent for the News Gazette's annual High School Confidential. Was informed a lighting upgrade to LED fixtures is complete and is anticipated to generate savings on electric bills. Heard the district has received the $20,000 from former Superintendent Dan Brew that was agreed to in a settlement. Was told the district's Rural Education Achievement Program grant came in at $24,470 for 2020-21, above the $21,000 received the previous year. Learned that non-tenured teachers will still be evaluated as long as the district continues in-person classes. Changes may be made if the district needs to shift to all remote for an extended period of time. And approve policy changes as recommended by the Illinois Association of School Boards. Most had to do with Title IX, but another increases the number of days a former teacher can substitute from 100 to 120 days. Seavers Center grand opening December 1st, September 22nd. The official grand opening of the Arthur Buzz Seavers Center has been set for Tuesday, December 1st. It will feature both boys and girls basketball games against Olympia. The girls' game will tip off at 5:30 p.m., with the boys' contest following at 7:15 p.m. Junior varsity games will be played in Miller Gym. All teams that will use the new Seavers Gymnasium will be represented at the game, including senior players and head coaches for basketball, volleyball, wrestling, and cheerleading. Longtime school employee Buzz Seavers will cut a ribbon to officially open the competition-sized gym. Additional details will be announced later, including allowable crowd. The game will be streamed online, even if fans are not allowed in the stands. The Seavers Center is nearly complete, with bleacher installation finishing up. It would have opened up in the fall during volleyball season, but the Spiker campaign has been moved to next spring due to IHSA-related COVID precautions. Business District Grant Programs Get a Makeover, by Steve Hoffman, September 22nd. Now that there is a more stable funding mechanism for downtown development through a recently established business district, city officials in Monticello say it's time for its downtown grant programs to, grow up. That has led to the drafting of a formal business development improvement program with more strict guidelines that include redevelopment agreements with applicants in order to receive grants. It also allows for 2 application periods per year instead of the current annual distribution, and basically combines the current facade improvement and life safety grant programs. I've been through all 8 Monticello Main Street directors, and they've all had kind of the same issue with how the facade grant program was administered, said City Community Development Director Callie Jo McFarland. It was kind of loosey-goosey. It was subject to different interpretations. One director would say this was okay, another would say it wasn't, she told the City Council on September 14th. McFarland added the new mechanism means council members will also approve grants through a formal ordinance instead of through the monthly claims process. This is a more transparent mechanism, she said. It's kind of making our program a little more grown up, I think. The plan would combine and replace the current facade and life safety grant programs, which have been totaling about $50,000 in allocations yearly. Council members were receptive. Alderman Mike Kuhn did wonder if it was unrealistic for December applications to be judged around the holidays. The last 2 weeks of December, that's around the holidays. Is that feasible, considering the time of the year? Asked Kuhn. McFarland responded that the people who would be involved with compiling scores for grant applications were pretty comfortable with that. Projects that address any blighting in the business district, facilitate repair, renovation, and rehabilitation, address public safety, improve city infrastructure, and/or enhance the sales and property tax base can apply. If you work toward one factor, you're going to accomplish more than one. They're all related, said McFarland. Applicants must be the property owner or tenant that is within the business zone, which includes the downtown square area and several blocks around it. The business district was approved by the City Council in 2019. Funded by an added 1% sales tax, city officials expected to generate about $200,000 per year to start, dollars that can be poured back into improving that area. Other information about the Business District Building Improvement Program. Redevelopment agreements between the applicant and the city are required before a grant is awarded. The City Council approves all program funds and can award beyond the limit of a 50% match up to $10,000 if it desires. An applicant is limited to 1 application every 2 years. Preference will be given to locally owned, independent, and non-franchised or chain businesses. Franchises and chains are eligible, but will receive fewer points in the scoring system. A review committee that includes representation from the Monticello Chamber of Commerce and Monticello Main Street will recommend awards, and applications will be accepted twice per year, December 1st through 15th for January awards, and June 1st through 15th for July awards. This is a more formal and transparent program than we've ever had before. It's multi-agency involvement. It's public-private partnership, said City Administrator Terry Summers. 9 new cases of COVID-19 over the weekend in DeWitt County. By Steve Hoffman, September 22nd. 9 new positive tests for COVID-19 were reported in DeWitt County Saturday and Sunday by the DeWitt Piatt Bi-County Health Department. No new cases were announced over the weekend in Piatt County. The new cases in DeWitt included 5 in Clinton, 2 in Kenny, and 1 each in Waynesville and Farmer City. 3 people are currently hospitalized. DeWitt County remains on the Illinois warning list for COVID-19. Please remember to wear a mask when in public, said David Remert, administrator of the Bi-County Health Agency. Piatt County has had a total of 136 cases, and DeWitt County 108. Statewide, An additional 1,531 new confirmed cases were reported Tuesday, including 30 additional deaths. The preliminary 7-day statewide positivity for cases as a percent of total tests from September 15th through September 21st is 3.5%. Obituaries. Chalice June Black, 91, of Monticello, passed away on September 18th at the Piatt County Nursing Home. Private services will be held in Oak Grove Cemetery in Cowden. Lockard Green Funeral Home in Cowden is assisting the family. Ruth L. Roberts, 92, passed away September 18th at Arbor Rose Memory Care Home in Monticello. Visitation and funeral were held on Mondays, September 21st. In lieu of flowers, please make memorial donations to the Monticello United Methodist Church. Mildred Balsrud, age 97, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, September 15th. A private funeral was held for the family on Saturday, September 19th. Memorials may be made in her name to Emmanuel Lutheran Church, 902 Cleveland Avenue, Charleston, 61920. Girls' cross-country team remains undefeated by Jason Brown, PCJR correspondent, September 22nd. The Monticello High School girls and boys cross-country teams competed in the Olney Invitational at Olney Central College September 19th and a meet at St. Joseph last Tuesday. Girls' team. The girls' team dominated the 10-team Olney Invitational with the low score of 16 to stay undefeated on the season. Richland County placed second but was 72 points behind Monticello. Casey Westfield placed third and Newton fourth. Mabry Brune won the meet with a time of 16:23.2, and the next three spots went to Rachel Kuhn, Estella Miller, and Grace Talbert. Kuhn placed second with a time of 17:15.9, and Miller ran a 17:27.8 for third. Talbert followed in fourth place with a time of 17:38.9, while Kiara Welter slotted in at seventh with a time of 18:54.5. Rose Talbert barely missed a top 10 finish with a time of 19:11.9 at 11th place, and Emma Brown ran a 19:19.6 for 13th place. Joe Walker rounded out the Sages times with a 24th place finish at 20:42.4. Against St. Joseph, the Sages again dominated the meet, 15-66. The Sages swept the first 8 spots and first 10 of 11 finishes. Brune won the meet with a time of 18:27, and Miller followed in second at 19:17. Kuhn's 19:36 was good enough for third place, and Grace Talbert took fourth with a time of 20:09. Welter followed in fifth place with a time of 21:10, and Emma Brown crossed the line 5 seconds later. Rose Talbert was the 8th straight Sage to cross the line at 21:55, while Emma Kallenbach's time of 22:15 placed her 10th. Joe Walker ran a 22:22 for 11th place, and Cora Sawinski ran a 22:50 for 13th place. Boys team. For the boys team, Monticello placed third with a team score of 71 at the Olney Invitational at Olney Central College on Saturday. Host Richland County won the meet with a low score of 39, while Mattoon placed second with 55 points. The rest of the teams followed in order: Centennial, Newton, Effingham, Teutopolis, Mount Carmel, Altamont, and Dietrich. Josh Basor led the Sages with a third-place finish and a time of 15:13.14. Sean Derby and Joey Wenke placed 11th and 16th, respectively, with times of 15:56.93 and 16:19.12. Logan Sikorsky ran a 16:42.12 for 22nd place, and Rylan Good followed in 25th place at 16:47.78. Jacob Elston's 17:23.99 was good for 40th, and Charlie Hill placed 42nd at 1730.96. Ethan Robson rounded out the Sage's times with a 45th place finish at 1736.23. Against St. Joseph, Basor won the meet with a time of 1703. Derby and Wenke placed second and third, respectively, with times of 1705 and 1750. Sikorsky took sixth place with a time of 1821, and Ethan Robson rounded out the top 10 with a time of 1838. Jacob Elston, Ryland Good, and Charlie Dill finished 13th, 14th, and 15th with times of 1858, 1905, and 1909 in that order. Monticello is set to travel back to St. Joseph for the 9 a.m. St. Joe Classic on Saturday. Overall, Mom, Thinking Back on My Sewing Days by Mary Latta, September 17th. I was surprised to read that in 1982, President Ronald Reagan issued a proclamation declaring September as National Sewing Month. I was so excited when I read that, since some of my best memories have been those of when I was sewing. Whether with a needle and thread or on a machine, I have always enjoyed sewing. There's something very magical about turning scraps of material into items you can wear or hang on your window or lay your head on. Okay, so maybe wearing my childhood sewing projects in public was not something I would recommend, but I was certainly proud of what I created for my Barbie doll. Seems like back in the day, everyone knew how to sew. Maybe because that skill was handed down from grandparents who survived the Great Depression and could not afford to shop out of catalogs or department stores. My grandma stitched very colorful play clothes for my siblings and myself out of, get this, none other than feed sack material. Of course, those days of feed sacks being made of cloth have long since passed, and burlap might be a bit itchy. My other grandmother made a career of sewing. She had a steady flow of customers needing alterations. Work she did from home, as well as for one of the biggest department stores in Kankakee. She could sew anything from tailor suits to sundresses. Grandma handed down her sewing skills to her daughter, who handed the needle and thread down to me so I could pass the skill on to my children. I genuinely enjoy sewing and followed my grandmother's footprint. I was able to stay home with my children when they were young by taking in alterations, which eventually developed into a full-time job sewing fully washable stuffed animals, many with interchangeable outfits. I felt so blessed when my grandmother sewed my wedding dress. It was not only beautiful, but something that kept blessing my family time and again. It seems such a waste to tuck that beautiful gown away and never use it again. So after the birth of my oldest daughter, when I needed a baptismal gown, I decided, why not? I found a pattern for a baptismal gown, then took the material from the train of my wedding dress and created the perfect gown, which all my children wore for their ceremony. And when it came time to find a first Holy Communion dress for Stephanie, I decided to turn my wedding dress into her first communion gown. Fortunately, I was very thin and petite when I married my kid's father, so I really did not have a whole lot of work to do in remaking the dress to fit her. Something all six of my girls wore for their first communion, along with my wedding veil redesigned for the occasion. Sadly, fewer and fewer people are sewing these days. It seems store-bought clothes have all but replaced homemade clothing. Tragically, even if a button comes off, you see folks tossing or donating perfectly good outfits. So, that is why I feel it is so fitting that we celebrate this month to stitch a few memories. The timing couldn't be more perfect during this pandemic, since we've all been in lockdown anyway. It was because I raised a mob of kids that friends and neighbors were always donating clothes to our family. Even though my children were little people, we would receive tons of clothes that were 10 times the size of any of us. That's when I took advantage of rainy days to have my children cut off buttons and rip zippers out of clothes that were far too big for any of us to wear. Then I would turn around and utilize those pieces for new outfits I would stitch together. In fact, if the material from those clothes was of good quality, I would set it aside to create new outfits, or let the girls make doll clothes with it or something as simple as a pillow. I did not have to spend a dime on material to teach my girls to sew. There was always plenty of scraps laying around the house. My grandmothers will never go down in history for sewing anything as famous as the first American flag, like Betsy Ross hand-stitched, but their legacy will live on. They handed down a valuable gift that keeps on giving. Until next time, God bless. Letter from Birdland, Waiting for the Buffalo? By Mary Lucille Hayes, September 17th. I had just fed the dogs and was about to bring in the cat's dish when a truck came down the lane. "Hush, Cullen," I said, "it's just Gail." Though why she'd come so early for our walk, I didn't know. I still needed to get dressed and brush my hair. I would have liked to have had a cup of coffee first. But as the truck got closer, I saw it was not Gail, but our farmer neighbor. "Oh, Jim, you caught me in my jammies and without hearing aids." Jim hopped out of his truck, smiling broadly. I cupped my hand around my ear. My hand hearing aid works surprisingly well in a pinch. "The buffalo are out," he said by way of greeting. I smiled, momentarily disoriented. I thought he meant they were on display and we should go see them, maybe in a parade? But why so early in the morning? The buffalo farm stands 3 crooked miles from here. We often drive by and watch them in the pasture, usually in the distance. On rare occasions, they forage up near the fence. The calves come close by. We like to impress visitors with this view. "They're in the corn," explained Jim. "We're telling everybody." And then I knew they were not on parade, but at large. "Oh, I'll get the dogs in," I said, and Jim agreed it was a good idea. I texted Gail and a few other friends that Jim might have missed. Gail lives even closer to the herd than we do. I spent much of the morning peering out the window. When Michael got up, I told him we would have to forego our usual coffee walk to survey the yard. But my husband wasn't about to let a few old buffalo scare him. He went out despite my warnings, scoffing at my idea that a buffalo or 12 might stampede out of the corn. Later, we could see the flashing lights of the sheriff's cars blocking our road by our grass waterway. The top of the box truck was visible over the corn. Michael walked down to visit with the folks on the road, who told him they had found some in our field by the back by the timber. So my worry wasn't that far-fetched. Buffalo could, in fact, come rumbling out of the corn. But now someone had spotted a few of them with a drone up by the cell tower. The latest dispatch from the sheriff's office said that all but four of the 40 had been caught. Later, Michael was making his afternoon rounds of the yard and came to find me in the house. He made his hand motion that means, "Come quick, I found something you'll want to see." I followed, protesting that I was in my socks, and if it was a buffalo, I'd rather watch from the window. He led me to the chicken coop, where the chickens were gathering, preparing for dusk. He pointed to the top of the wall, and there, caught in the chicken wire, was a hummingbird. He ran to bring me a stool to stand on, and working from both sides of the wire, we released the poor thing. I got its head out first, but I couldn't let go of the wire. It wouldn't let go of the wire. Michael gently tapped its claws from the outside and it loosened its grip. It lay in my hand so weak, its feathers were iridescent green. We carried it to the hummingbird feeder and I stuck its beak in. It was too weak to hover, so it lay in my hand, pulsing. With its breath or heartbeat or swallowing the sugar water, I couldn't tell which. When I pulled it out, it gave a tiny beep and plunged its beak back into the feeder. I let it feed a few minutes more, and with another beep, it took sudden flight over the ornamental quince bush. We withdrew from the feeder. Roman beauty, release peace, blessed be.